This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
We are surrounded by plastic everything. Most of us know that isn't good for us or the earth. Bits of plastic are filling up the land, sea, and pretty well every creature, including our own bodies. But did you know the plastic industry is a major driver behind climate change? And the fossil fuel industry plans to make much, much more of it. This is all in a report, Plastic and Climate, the Hidden Costs of a Plastic Planet, that was released by the Center for International Environmental Law, a nonprofit environmental organization in the U.S. We have reached the president and CEO of the center, attorney Carol Muffett. From Washington, D.C., Carol Muffett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's very nice to be here.
Why did an organization focused on law publish a fully researched report on the climate impact of using plastics?
I think the answer to that is because when we first began to look at the issue of plastics and what we could do to confront the plastics crisis, what we realized was that most of the attention on plastics was going into the problem of plastics once they were all already in the oceans. And the problem there is what you're dealing with is a massive cleanup operation. And so what we wanted to understand is where does the problem of plastics really begin? And that led us to, you know, tracing the plastics supply chain to its very beginning. And that's at the oil rigs and gas well pads where the feedstocks that form plastics start their lives. And once we understood that 99% of what goes into plastics is actually fossil fuels, that led us to start thinking about, well, when we look from the wellhead through the pipelines to the production to out in the environment, what is the climate impact of all this plastics being produced, being used, being disposed of, and a lot of it either being incinerated or released into the environment?
Every country, as you know, on the planet pretty well signed the Paris Agreement, trying to keep the Earth under 2 degrees C of warming. Scientists warn even 1.5 degrees is dangerous on many levels. We're starting to experience that now. Can we reach those lofty Paris goals if the plastic industry reaches their goals?
Quite simply, the answer is no. I think one of the remarkable things that we found in our research is that at every stage in its life cycle, plastics releases greenhouse gases, often in massive quantities. And those quantities are growing. As you alluded, you know, in your opening remarks, we're seeing the industry invest massively in the build-out of new infrastructure for plastics. The American Chemistry Council has projected that the industry will invest more than $200 billion in more than 300 new or expanded plastic and petrochemical facilities between now and 2025. And if all of that infrastructure gets built, what it means is the infrastructure, the production of plastics would expand dramatically, and so too would the emissions from plastics. And if that happens, there is no way that we can keep the world below 2 degrees, and certainly not below 1.5.
Right. And we cheer when coal-fired power plants close to be replaced by solar, wind, or hydro energy. But from the sound of your report, we may be sort of replacing those coal stations with the emissions from plastics. Could you explain how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this was one of the things that was really striking, is that when you look at where the CO2 emissions from plastics come from, the truth is they come from every link in the life cycle. There are methane and other greenhouse gases released from fracking, you know, from fracking pads and wellheads. There is methane leakage from pipelines and compressor stations. And I think one of the things that was really striking about our research is it becomes clear when you look at the details that the U.S. doesn't even know how many miles of pipelines or how many compressor stations it has, by an order of magnitude, and yet we know that there are methane leakages widespread in these systems. There are hidden emissions that come from the clearing of forests and the clearing of agricultural lands to build those pipelines. And the biggest sources of emissions for plastics actually come from producing the plastics themselves. The refining of oil and particularly gas into plastics is one of the most energy-intensive and one of the most carbon-intensive of all industrial processes, and it's also one of the fastest-growing. And one of the things that we found is even if you were to replace all of the massive amounts of energy that it takes to fuel a plastics refinery with 100% renewable energy, which is nearly impossible to do, even that would only cut the emissions from plastic production in half because the chemical processes themselves release so much CO2. And so when you're talking about adding massive new waves of plastic infrastructure to the economy and to the environment, what we found was it was the equivalent of adding hundreds of new coal-fired power plants to the environment at the same time. Between now and 2030, if we continue on our current trajectory, emissions from plastic production and use and disposal would be equivalent to 295 coal plants. If you look out to 2050, it becomes 615 coal plants operating 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And what's really, I think, one of the really surprising things in our research is that those emissions from plastics don't stop once the plastic reaches the end of its usable life. Plastics release greenhouse gases when they're released into the environment, and they release greenhouse gases when they're incinerated, as more and more plastics are. Just the incineration of plastics alone between now and 2050 could add 4 gigatons of carbon to the atmosphere.
But I worked with a lot of activists at Greenpeace USA in the Toxics campaign, for example, and there learned a lot about plastics and what happens when you burn them and incinerate them in particular, all the terrible things that come out for our health.
Yeah, exactly. And we have a companion report to our plastics and climate report on plastics and health. And one of the things it actually talks about is the human health impacts, both of plastic production and of incineration.
What's the name of that report?
It's called The Hidden Cost of Plastic, Plastic and Health. And when you combine that 4 gigatons from incineration with the massive amounts of carbon emitted by the production of plastics, what you get is 56 gigatons of carbon. It's hard to understand these figures, but to put that number in perspective, 56 gigatons of carbon is equal to about 13% of the Earth's entire remaining carbon budget if we're going to stay below 1.5 degrees. 13% of our entire remaining carbon budget for the planet just to produce plastics. And so that's why we can say with such confidence that if the industry succeeds in its plan, there is no way we can succeed in keeping the Earth below 1.5 degrees.
Well, you may be wondering, why would I call you up about this report a year after it came out? And the answer is I was stimulated by an article that I read December 2nd, 2020, in the Barents Observer, of all places. That's based in Scandinavia. So journalist Atle Stahlson worked under this headline, "The Great Global Energy Shift Could Push Moscow Towards Plastics Production on Arctic Tundra. Russia's powerful petroleum industry feels a mounting pressure from alternative energy sources, and strong voices now say the country's vast natural gas resources in the Arctic should be used in petrochemical production," end quote. Now, that smells to me like an end run around what we're trying to do for climate change, a game plan for big fossil fuel producers to keep drilling, even as we try to slash emissions from the power sector. Now they'll just sell it and embed it as plastics instead. And as your report outlines, that's another disaster.
I think that's exactly right. And what you described for Russia is precisely what we've seen other carbon majors companies doing, other big oil and gas companies doing. I think I mentioned that 99% of what goes into plastics is actually fossil fuels. And one consequence of that, and one thing that most people don't recognize, is that many of the biggest producers of plastics and plastic feedstocks are oil and gas companies. Exxon, Chevron, Shell, Total, ConocoPhillips. These are names that you think of when you think of oil, gas, and climate change, and they are the same names that you should think of when you're thinking about climate change. And what you described for Russia is precisely what we've seen with respect to the major oil and gas companies. They've seen that there is no long-term future in oil, and the promise of natural gas as a future energy supply is quickly vanishing, even if the companies are telling a different story. And so if you actually look at the company's business plans, what you find again and again is they are looking to offset those lost sales of oil and gas by increasing their investments in plastics and other petrochemicals. The idea is precisely, you know, our products have to go somewhere. If they can't go into fueling cars and fueling power plants, we'll bury them in plastic. And the problem with that is not only that it contributes to the plastics crisis, but it simultaneously contributes to the climate crisis and helps companies prop up business models that are fundamentally incompatible with a safe climate.
So plastic is really everything that we get. It's made out of these little beads that are all glued together to make whatever shape we have, whether it's a toy gun or anything, a plastic bag for our groceries. And then it gets out into the environment and these microbeads break down. I've read about marine animals that mistake microbeads of plastic for fish eggs and they eat that. And we have birds with their stomachs full of plastic and all that. But does this plasticized landscape continue to release some of those fossil fuels, if you will, back into the atmosphere as they degrade? Do we know that?
It absolutely does. Research done out of the University of Hawaii that we discussed in our report found that as plastics break down in the environment, they off-gas methane and other fossil fuels on a more or less continuous basis. And I think this is important because the sheer volume of microplastics in the environment is staggeringly difficult to quantify. There are, you know, the most recent estimate is that there are 57 trillion particles of microplastics just floating at the Earth's surface. But those 57 trillion microparticles represent less than 1% of a single year's emissions of plastics. And the researchers at the University of Hawaii also found that even as plastics are emitting greenhouse gases while they sit at the ocean surface, plastics that are sitting on beaches, on shorelines, on agricultural lands are exposed to more sunlight and they're emitting greenhouse gases at an even faster rate. And unfortunately, you know, I wish I could tell you that was the biggest climate impact from microplastics, but our research suggests that it's not. There is an emerging body of research that looks at how the accumulating microplastics in the ocean are affecting phytoplankton and zooplankton. These are the microscopic plants and microscopic animals that form the very foundation of oceanic food systems and ultimately play a big part in human food systems as well. But in addition to being a critical part of food webs, phytoplankton and zooplankton play an essential role in the ocean's function as an oceanic carbon sink. A huge portion of the greenhouse gases that humans have emitted over time are actually stored safely away in the oceans, in the deep ocean waters where they can't interact with the atmosphere. So, but for that oceanic carbon sink, climate change would be even worse than it is now. And a key way that that oceanic carbon sink functions is that phytoplankton floating at the ocean surface fix carbon into a biological form, and then zooplankton eat the phytoplankton, and when they die, they sink to the ocean bottom, and that carbon is locked away. But what we're finding, what scientists have found in every ocean basin where they looked, whether it's off the coast of China or off the coast of India or off the coast of Kenya or off the coast of Oregon, is that microplastics are being ingested by phytoplankton and zooplankton alike. And when they're ingested by phytoplankton, they reduce their ability to photosynthesize and absorb carbon. And when they're ingested by zooplankton, for many zooplankton species, they're making the species eat less, they're making them reproduce less effectively, and they're making them die sooner. And so what is the effect of all of this accumulating plastic on that oceanic carbon pump? We simply don't know. But the scale of the risk is profound, and I think that was one of the most chilling conclusions from our report, is there's this massive experiment going on in our oceans that we don't know the outcome from, and that experiment will just accelerate as we add more and more microplastics to the ocean.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Carol Muffett, as we said, you lead a law-based nonprofit, the Center for International Environmental Law. Do you see legal avenues to rein in the coming wave of plastic production and consumption to save our climate hopes?
I think there are a number of legal avenues to address these problems, and that's ultimately what brought us to this work. You know, CL has been very active, for instance, in working to build international legal responses to the plastics crisis. Last year, parties to the Basel Convention on Transboundary Waste added plastics to a list of restricted wastes under that convention, making it fundamentally harder for people to ship plastic waste to places where it can't be managed properly. We are also working with groups around the world and within the United Nations to get the UN to launch a new set of negotiations to develop a global plastics convention. And that, too, will help us address the problem of plastics globally. But a lot of the fight against the plastic buildout is going on one plant at a time. And here we see, you know, we see a lot of promise. I think the most recent evidence of this is with communities in St. James Parish, Louisiana, who are facing the build-out of a massive plastic plant proposed by Formosa Plastics. Those communities, supported by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Center for Biological Diversity, have been incredibly effective at forcing the plant to defend its permits and forcing the government to recognize that many of the permits were granted improperly. And I think this brings me to maybe a more hopeful note, which is because plastics is so deeply linked to the economics of oil and gas, what we've seen is that the pandemic crisis has really fundamentally accelerated the shift away from oil and gas in many economies. And the plastic and petrochemical companies who had been betting on a future filled with cheap oil and cheap natural gas are now finding that the economics of these plastic plants may simply not make sense anymore. And that itself opens up a whole new realm of legal strategies where we look at our companies assessing climate risks. Are they disclosing them to workers? Are they disclosing them to investors? And so the answer is there are a number of legal strategies to address this crisis. And the key, you know, I think the key thing is not to rely on any one legal tool when our toolkit is so large.
Your report also recommends a transition to zero waste communities. The Zero Waste International Alliance exists. There is a branch here in Canada. I found listings of cities in several parts of the world with zero waste as a goal. These include Vancouver, Canada, Austin, Texas, and San Francisco. But so far, I have not found a real zero waste community in 2020. Can that be done as a single city in a sea of plastics all around?
It can actually be done. And if you watch the film, the documentary film, The Story of Plastics, there is a long interview with a Filipino community leader named Froilan Great. And Froilan led his community to develop a true zero waste community in one of the countries that's really at the epicenter of the plastics crisis. And they were able to do it in ways that actually reduced their overall cost of waste management dramatically and became, you know, became a true zero waste city. Now, ultimately, they identified there are small quantities of waste that they just weren't able to eliminate and just weren't able to manage properly. And it's precisely those sorts of plastics for which companies should truly be held accountable. We're seeing a big rise in many parts of the global south in communities and cities and countries being pushed to accept what are called plastic sachets, which are layers and layers of plastic combined with metal, combined with paper, combined with inks in ways that make them truly and completely unrecyclable. And I think it speaks to the fundamental importance in any strategy based on zero waste communities of recognizing that getting to true zero waste is going to require not only changes in consumer behaviors and changes in how communities are operating, but holding companies accountable for the sort of packaging they're producing.
Yes, we're sorting out our plastics in our recycling bins here in my community. And we were shipping it all to China for them to figure it out. And now that has been stopped by the Chinese. They don't want to be the world's dump. And as far as I know, right now, our local plastics are going into a landfill. People were talking about making plastic picnic benches, but that really never went anywhere. I just don't see a good way for recycling to work. And then we hear about biodegradable plastic. Is that a good solution? Is there a green way to make and use plastic?
So first on recycling, you're exactly right. I mean, the truth is there's no way to recycle our way out of the plastics crisis. And the experience with China is evidence of that. You know, what was going on with China for decades was that Canada and the United States and many European countries and even Japan were effectively hiding their plastic waste problems by shipping that problem to China. And then ironically, when plastic pollution was showing up in the environment, in the seas around China, in the Philippines, and Indonesia, they were pointing to Asia and saying, look, the plastic problem is all about Asia. But in fact, the plastic problem was us shipping our plastic problem to other countries and forcing them to deal with it. Now, with respect to bioplastics, I think one of the things to bear in mind is that first of all, something that can be a bioplastic and nonetheless be in every real sense plastics, which means that it behaves in the environment just like any other plastic, then it's no better for the environment. One of the other challenges with bioplastics is that many companies, you know, combine a small amount of biological material with a large amount of fossil-based plastics. And they label the resulting container as containing bioplastics, which is technically true, but nonetheless profoundly misleading. And so what we see with bioplastics is it is as much a marketing ploy as it is a real solution to the plastic crisis. There's a very small category of bioplastics that are both truly 100% bioplastics and are also effectively and easily biodegradable. But those products are currently the exception rather than the rule. And so it's really important to recognize that bioplastics, you know, can contribute to a solution, but the real solution is going to be in reducing the amount of plastics we produce in the first place.
Carol, if you had a good connection directly into the new Biden-Harris administration in the U.S., what would you advise them to do about plastics and climate?
Well, that's an easy one because just yesterday, more than 500 organizations actually released the president's plastic action plan. And UCL was one of many contributors to that plan. And it includes a number of common sense measures that the Biden administration can take. Rejoining the Paris Agreement is one of them. Reinstating the crude oil export ban, which in addition to driving the climate crisis, contributes to the plastic crisis. Instating much more stringent requirements for the permitting of new plastic production facilities. Ending subsidies for fossil fuels and plastic production. In other words, there are a whole range, and critically, joining the global community in negotiating a new plastics agreement. So there are a whole range of steps that a Biden administration could take to actually turn the U.S. from an obstruction in responding to the plastics crisis to an ally.
Where can we find that new plan, and where can we find your report on plastic and climate?
The best place to find that new plan, CL has it on its own website, but the easiest place is actually to go to the Center for Biological Diversity's website and look for President's Plastic Action Plan, and you can find it there. You can find CL's plastic work, including our report on the climate, at our website, www.ciel.org.
We've been speaking with lawyer and longtime environmental activist Carol Muffett. He is president and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law. You can find a link to their website and the report and the things we've been talking about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Carol, thank you for taking the time to help us out on this.
Alex, it was truly a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.